Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Diane Niati. Welcome, Diane.
Thanks, Michael.
Now, you have led a very colourful life as far as I can see, but you currently have a wonderful job working for a group of ferries.
Now,
what's the name of that organisation?
The name is Ladybird Entertainment.
And what's your role there?
Well, I do some of the office work, help with the basic computers things that you have to do. And I also help with costuming, and sometimes I get to be a fairy or a pirate as well.
Now, I think this business is well known all around, including around Fremantle. And you get to, as you say, act as a fairy from time to time. Do you have some sort of background in theatre? Tell me.
Oh, yes. The first time I was on the stage, I was 2 years old. And it was at the Capitol Theatre. Yes, I was a powder puff.
What is a powder puff? What did it look like, at least?
It was a little pink satin dress with cotton wool around the edges.
Well, it sounds too beautiful to imagine, really. But did your family have some background in theatre? How did you come to be a powder puff?
Well, my grandfather was in the Wattle Follies with his twin brother, and that was in the 1900s. It was a vaudeville act. And we always sang around the piano. I've got various family members that are in film and theatre. My son loves Shakespeare. He's acted in a few. It was Hamlet once with Grads, the graduate group from UWA.
Yeah. Now, your grandfather's troupe, was that a family troupe or was it a big commercial?
I think they were always very involved with community, so I think it was like a community fundraising group, because he was also involved with raising money for the South Perth Community Hospital. So, yeah, they were quite involved. I think it was probably used as a fundraiser.
And your grandfather, what was his forte in the theatre?
Oh, singing and dancing.
Singing and dancing. And
yeah.
Do you sing?
Yes.
And do you dance?
Yes, I do.
So when you were younger, did you have a passion for dance?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And how did that express itself? How old were you and what did you get involved in?
Oh, well, in the early days, you know, it was all ballet and tap. And then as I got older, I loved ballroom dancing. Yes.
And other forms of dancing? What do you dance and where do you do it?
Okay, I got into partner dancing again, because for years there was all the disco phase and everyone just danced on their own. But then I ran the community centre in Fremantle and we had lots of people from Chile and El Salvador come as refugees. And I became great friends with them and they invited me to their parties and they were dancing in couples. They called it salsa and merengue. And so that started me off dancing in couples again, which was fantastic because it hadn't happened for 20 years. So, and then I started taking lessons. One of the people who came out that was with that group, Miguel, he was teaching salsa. So I started taking lessons, and from there I've just taken lots and lots of... I do lots of dance lessons now, yeah.
Now, one might think that your life is or has been consumed by dance, but I think it's been more than that. You've mentioned the meeting place. That's very well known around Fremantle. Just tell me this. How long have you been living in and around Fremantle?
For 34 years.
Well, that's quite a time. And where were you brought up?
I was brought up south of the river. Our family always lived around in the Como area since 1829, actually, when they came on the first passenger ship, the Callista. So always based around south of the river, yes.
So your ancestor was on pretty much the first ship that arrived here and brought settlers to Western Australia?
The first passenger ship, yes.
And his or her name?
Oh, they were the Kings, husband and wife, and two children. And my direct matrilineal ancestor was born 6 weeks after they arrived.
Oh my goodness! And what did they do?
They unfortunately were indentured labourers, so they had quite a hard time. In fact, within 12 months of arriving, Harriet King had had a baby, but her husband and her son had both drowned in the river.
Oh my goodness! So this sort of inspirational tale about engaging with life has this very sad beginning to it. Do you know anything more about how that happened?
Well, I don't know how they drowned. I've been trying to research, but the tale is actually one of resilience, because my great-great-great-great-grandmother was left a single parent with two children, and she was making nets for the fishermen, and within 3 months had married a soldier and just basically got on with life. So our whole family is quite adventurous and resilient. I think we had to be.
Did she have more children?
Yes, she did.
And whereabouts was she settled most of the time? She stayed in the Perth area?
Yes, she had quite a difficult life. I think her husband was away a lot, probably doing things that we don't like to talk about, like in Pinjarra. And she had several more children, but there's articles in the paper that I saw in Fremantle Library, because I'm trying to do a bit of research, and he basically disowned her and said he wasn't responsible for her debts. So she...
This is the soldier husband.
The soldier husband.
So the marriage didn't work out.
Well, she had quite a few children, but she ended up surviving without his support for about 20 more years.
Now,
yeah, Harriet King, I think she's a bit... She was a bit famous for all the wrong reasons.
Oh, was she really? So we'll let our faithful listeners go and do their research on Harriet King.
Go to the Fremantle Library.
And you mentioned Pinjarra, and you're plainly alluding to Europeans euphemistically call the Battle of Pinjarra, but others refer to as the Massacre of Pinjarra. Did Mr. King have some connection with that, do you know?
Well, it wasn't Mr. King, because...
Oh, it wasn't Mr. King,
died.
It was the soldier husband.
The soldier.
Yeah.
Can't even remember his name. Yes, because I was trying to do some research about Harriet and found that she wasn't on the census because they didn't count soldiers' wives. And basically, I think the 1931 or 32 census, I'd been informed that if they weren't on it, they were down in Pinjarra. So pretty sure that he was involved in that.
Yes. I think the records disclose at least the government account of what happened and how they went about it and who was in the party in 1834.
Yeah.
Come back to Fremantle then for the moment. You have an ancestor, two, and kids who arrive on the Calista.
Yes.
Back in 1829. They make their way one way and the other in the new colony. And here we are today with the descendant back living in Fremantle. We can just about see the port from here.
Yeah.
Now, you came here 34 years ago.
Yeah.
And what brought you to Fremantle then? And where were you living?
I'd been living in the hills and just about to build a house up in the hills. But we had friends in Fremantle, and we used to come and visit them, and it was just at that time of the strip and the Cafe Society, and they seemed to be... He was a sculptor, and they very involved with the arts community down here. And just before we actually put in the plans to build the house, I just said, oh, can we please look for a house down here? So, found a place in Howell Street with beautiful stone house with ocean views on a big block, and it was just fantastic. Yeah, loved it.
Now, I think your life started to take different turns once you arrived in Fremantle, didn't it?
Yes.
What happened and how did you become involved in the whole nuclear protestation movement at the time?
Well, the very morning that I... first morning I woke up, I stepped onto my front veranda that had beautiful ocean views with my two-year-old, or maybe, yeah, he was a bit younger than that, in my arms, and I saw a gigantic American aircraft carrier that just seemed to take up the whole horizon. And I was just appalled, because I'm thinking I'm coming to this wonderful community arts-oriented place, and there's the beautiful ocean, and everything seemed lovely, and then there was just this dreadful sight. Yeah.
So what did you do about that?
Well, my child was in a playgroup at the meeting place, and so I just made a little sign that said, I don't like this big aircraft carrier here, and how about we get all our babies and we go down and we protest? And so the women and I got some nappies. In those days we had cloth nappies. And we had three cloth nappies pinned together that said, bombs kill babies. And the other three said, we love life. So we went with our babies onto the ship. Somewhere along the line, I'd heard that there was a group of people that were lining up to go, because they used to let you go on tours of the ships in those days. They were lining up and they were sort of like protesters. So we said, let's do that. So we took our babies and these things, and we went ostensibly on the tour of the ship until we got to a certain place, and then we went to the side and hung the nappies over the side.
So did you get some good press out of that?
Well, yes, there are some photos of us.
Now, you've mentioned the meeting place, and we'll come back to that in a moment, but did you find a willing and ready group of supporters to go on this protest march with you?
Yeah, they still talk about it. Yeah, they want it, because they probably had been here longer than me, and they were aware that the ships were coming in and people didn't like it. I was from the hills. I didn't actually. It was just the first thing I'd seen. But they were more experienced with what was going on, and they were really willing and happy to come.
So at that point, a mother of a small baby, had you had any prior sort of political awakening, or had you been called to action on earlier occasions?
I did when Whitlam got kicked out. That, up until then, I'd lived in Sydney in a fairly right-wing community in Northern Shore. You know, my first husband, private school boy, all of that. So liberal voters. I thought there was something not quite right going on, so I used to subscribe to the Bulletin and the National Geographic when I was 20-year-old housewife, because I wanted to know what was going on. So when Whitlam got kicked out, I thought that was the most appalling thing. That was, like, to me, it was a coup. And I was so appalled that then they could put in the opposition leader as Prime Minister, who hadn't... It was just all too much. So I went and joined the Labor Party at that stage. And so for a few years post-Whitlam, I was in the Labor Party, but then I didn't really like politics very much, so I dropped it. And, yeah.
But you've obviously remained engaged with what we might call political social causes.
Oh, I'm more involved with social causes than the bigger politics. Although I'm happy to go down, like, with the Beerlea wetlands and stand and, you
yes.
know.
And when did you first find yourself becoming involved in a social cause? What sorts of issues came up for you initially?
Initially, it was that Aboriginal people wanted to get... were offered some land by Whitlam in Wanneroo, and the people didn't want them, and I lobbied the council so that they could get it.
And was that successful?
Yes, they got the land.
So how did you become involved in that? What was your reason for becoming involved in Aboriginal land affairs?
because I, as a child, I used to love walking through the bush, and I fell in love with the bush, and then I realised that there were people who'd been here for a very, very long time. So I sought out to get to know Aboriginal people. Yeah.
Now, by the time you make it to Fremantle and go protesting with others, you're obviously fully engaged. And did that lead to more involvement?
Well, I went from being involved federally and doing a lot of things in the eastern states to wanting to come back and work in my own community, because I found the big picture a bit distressing for me. So I thought I could be more effective and more comfortable, and my family would be more comfortable if I was in community. So I was really working then at the meeting place, and working with migrants. We had, or refugees, we had people from 40 different cultures using the meeting place when I was there, including Indigenous, all sorts of, Indigenous involvement. And my take was a bit different. Previously, they wanted us to teach the people English or that sort of thing. I got the people from the different cultures to teach us about their culture. So that's where the music, that's where the dance, that's where they put on theatre shows, So there was, I turned it around so that we could learn about their cultures. Yeah.
Yes. Had there been anything like the meeting place before it?
Oh, the meeting place, well, no, but it had been going for a few years before I was there. Yeah, it was started by one of Catalini's sisters, I think, yeah.
And you had a sort of an active sort of weekday role, or
I was
regularly
the manager.
You're the manager.
Yeah.
And what did that involve you in doing, apart from the things you've described?
It was an adult education centre. So it was about involving the community and engaging them to basically teach each other. Yeah.
Now, the nuclear disarmament years also saw the election of Senator Joe Valentine to the Australian Parliament. Were you around when that was happening?
Oh, yeah. Well, there were 12 of us that got her elected, basically. We mainly were women with children, like breastfeeding children. We used to put lambskins on the floor under the desk, feed the babies, put them down, and then we ran the campaign. There were about 12 of us.
Well,
yeah.
That must have been a very heady period. What do you recall of it now?
Well, it was just, we were so idealistic. We were sort of, first thing that happened before we did anything, we had a workshop on non-violent communication and consensus decision making. So we started off very sort of innocently, doing everything right, and it just all took off. We had 6 weeks to run the campaign, and people just came in and did everything. A friend of mine made a film called Take Heart, which basically tells the story of it. And so people from all different walks of life, there were doctors against nuclear. The women from the doctors who all lived in Cottesloe and Claremont, they ran all the fundraising events because they had all the connections. And then I was a networker. So I basically networked so that we ended up with the polling booth staff throughout the whole of Western Australia. But the thing that got us really is, it was only a 6 week campaign. The biggest shock to all of us when we were at Joe's place is that she actually got elected. We were all in shock because Joe had a 2.5 year old. And it was like, what are we going to do? So I spent the first while when she went to Canberra, making casseroles and things for her poor husband, Peter, who was suddenly left with these children while she had to run off to Canberra. Yeah, it was...
Now, I understand that during the period of getting her elected, when the protest movement, the election process was getting underway that you were known, at least for a period, as Rainbow Dye. Is
yeah.
that right? How did that happen?
Oh, because once I'd been jumping on the warships, you know, I got involved with that sort of group of people, and there used to be big peace marches, and they'd all be down at the wharf. It was the time when it was 5 minutes to midnight, you know. We're expecting, well, it's almost gone back to that now. Anyway, but everyone was very dark. They were dressed in dark clothing, and everyone looked very miserable. And I thought we need to present positively to the public, you know, that we're not all crazy, dark people. We're families, and, you know. So I made this whole range of rainbow clothes for people to wear. And I used to sell them at the peace marches and things. And there were scarves and, T-shirts with peace doves on.
Now, at that time, and they were heady times, as I said earlier, we have a whole lot of what turns out to be non-violent protest, and that is very much part of Joe Valentine's philosophy.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you learn about how to protest yourself? Did it come naturally?
We studied it. We had, I've got still in my wardrobe, in my library, lots of books about there was a whole movement across the world called Groundswell, and there were techniques, there were philosophies that came from Martin Luther King and Gandhi, there were groups of people that studied it and then taught it, and that's what we did. We studied it, and then we would have these whole weekends where we'd learn ourselves, and then we'd go and teach. I remember going down into the forest and teaching people about what non-violence meant.
So when you said you went down to the forest to talk about what non-violence meant, was that in connection with the peace movement, or are we talking about other non-violent protests?
Well, Joe's got in on because the nuclear thing was so, but it was really the precursor to the Greens, because there were still things going, so there would be groups in the forest that were protesting one thing or another. So we would spend weekends and just teach them, basically, you know. And the basic philosophy was a fairly Eastern philosophy that I see the God in you and you see the God in me. And so whoever you were protesting against, you didn't see them as the enemy. It was like when we used to get on the warships and the people, the sailors would come and try and, you know, take the banners, and we'd just say, look, we don't want you to die in a nuclear war either, you know. So we're always trying to engage from a human level. That's basically what nonviolence was, yeah.
Now, that particular philosophy you've just described, not seeing those people who are the butt of the protest as your enemy, is that a philosophy that you still subscribe to?
Yeah.
And when you look back now to those years when all of that was happening in Fremantle, down on the wharf, and there was a political swell behind Joe Valentine, and you think about what's happening today, how do you see the development of the philosophy, the progress we've made or not made? How do you assess it all when you look back?
Well, I don't really look back. I look forward, and what I see now in Fremantle is, a couple of years ago I had an idea. I wanted to write some sort of a book about all the amazing people doing amazing things in Fremantle. I haven't got around to it yet, but I know at least 300 people that are doing creative things, earning money in creative ways, ethically, sustainably. There's all those words that have almost become cliches now. But there's such an array of amazing people doing amazing things that I think we've got like a microcosm of what's possible in a new way of being in the world. And so I'm really positive about it, and it's sort of, yes, the Belia campaign was quite incredible, the way they mobilised that.
Almost came out of nowhere, didn't it?
Appearing so, but this is where we might go back to say, now there's a third generation of people almost that are very aware of how to act politically. So I would be the grandmother, and then Sandy, who I work for, would be the mother, and then her daughter was doing the lock-ons, you know, and has through that met the most amazing group of young women and men, 16 and 17 years, who are politically active, who have got really interesting ways of earning money, very creative, and they're this third generation from me. So this is what I'm seeing. It's like it's almost become second nature for people to not just do the political activism, but they live their lives in a way that is full of consciousness. And mainly, the thing I find the most interesting is the creativity, the creation in action. It's not just sort of like the arts in terms of defining that, but it's so many different ways that people choose to be in the world, creating like a better place, and huge amounts of support for each other. And you know, our friend the other day, just walking along the beach, sees a homeless Aboriginal guy with a broken arm trying to open a rubbish bin, starts talking to him. The whole community gathers around, and he ends up getting medical treatment. His sister's taken him in. He's stopped drinking. He's got hope. You know, and this is just one action from one of our friends. And that sort of thing goes on all the time. You know, the street friends. I'm involved with Jennifer, who does the First Nations Homelessness Project, and she just does it all through Facebook, puts it out. There's a woman who's moving into a house. She's been homeless. She's 50. She's got nothing. The next thing, everyone has supplied everything she needs and taken it to her.
Now, I don't want to divert you from that, but an aspect of this I'm wondering, you're talking about women, you said men too, but were there gender politics, if you like, engaged in this process? Were women incredibly important?
Women just... Okay, if we go back to getting on the ships, it was women and their babies who got on the ships. The non-violence movement, there were a number of men involved, really good men, aware men. The election crew that got Joe in, probably 80% were women, some men. The people that I know that are doing really creative things in Fremantle, I wouldn't be able to work out, but I would say just roughly it might be 70% women, 30% men.
And what is it that causes this, if it's a phenomenon, this reality? What is it that produces women at the forefront of what you're talking about?
Well, I don't know, except I can only speak for my friends and myself, is we're not engaged in attempting to get status in the wider society. It's very much from the heart. It's almost, dare I say, a spiritual thing, but I wouldn't define it as that. But all of the people that I know, they come from a very big heart space, and they care and they support each other, and they're funny and kind and celebrate life and dance and sing. You know, it's not just being kind, it's just being full of life. And you do that and you're not worried about looking silly. You know what I mean? It's like you just do it because it's exciting and fun and wonderful. And that's the only thing that I can think of, because I've got three sons. I think boys And the boys and men I know can be caught up with the question, and what do you do? You know, and it, for a living, is it, does it have status? Do you, whether it's, do you have sporting prowess? Do you have a university education? Do you have a great job? And I think that could be still the pressure that men are facing. And if they face that sort of pressure, what time is there to then break out and do? I mean, there's this wonderful guy who is completely crazy, and he just lives across there. He lives in one of those houses that are main roads. He's building all these amazing hydroponic solar-powered gardens. They're all in levels. His name's Jason Homer. He's about 6'5" and blonde hair, and he's completely eccentric. But he's the sort of guy, like Robbie, who just follows their heart and is not looking for status. But he'd probably be a millionaire one day if it takes off, you know, these these gardens.
Well, what you've described so far as women are concerned is a woman who might be described as a sage woman. Now, tell me, did you not open a bookshop once upon a time in Ray Avenue?
Yeah.
And what was it called?
It was called Sage Woman. Yeah.
And what? Where did that come from, and how did it come about, and what stage in your life was that?
Sage Woman was meant to have a double meaning, sage meaning wise, and what I was attempting to do at the time was to depict the wise woman through all cultures and the way that they experience their spiritual connection, often to the land. So that was the part of it. And look, it was 20 odd years ago, but it was, I used to love getting photos of women with wrinkles and things. It was the beginning of counteracting the pressure that women felt to get facelifts and be forever young and forever gorgeous, and just, so it was partly that, and yes, it was really about wanting to inspire women to feel good about themselves and feel strong, with my main motivation being that if women felt really good about themselves and strong, that they would then be able to have very good relationships with men, because my passion has always been that men and women could get on well, because that to me is the most sacred harmony, you know, a good relationship between a man and a woman. I mean, what else is there? And then the creation of a child. So that to me, I suppose, was my biggest motivation, that I wanted, if women felt strong enough and good enough about themselves. So that was the reason I started Sage Woman.
So what sort of materials were you selling?
I was selling a lot of, at the time there was quite a lot of women writers like Mary Daly and, oh golly, I can't even remember most of them now, but they were really researching the, they called it the Her Story, like the history going back that involved women and women's spirituality. And Marit Gimbutas was an archaeologist that put forward theories about matriarchal cultures, pre-patriarchal. So I had a lot of those writers, plus a lot of writers about the way women express their spirituality. Because previous to that, I'd done quite a lot of research, you know, going up to the ashram just up here. But everything I read, it was saying men couldn't get enlightened if women were in the room. And it's like, well, where does that leave women? So I sort of went from, I mean, I started at the ashram because I took my peace friends, women who were getting tired and exhausted, I took them up to do meditation classes so that we could try and, you know, because we were getting tired. And then I found out that it didn't really suit me. So then I sort of started looking into the ways that women express their spirituality throughout the world. And I went to Ireland. Mary Daly is a brilliant woman, and she'd written a book about her journey around Ireland. So I went to Ireland and sought out all these ancient, you know, sacred sites. And
did you have any other philosophical influences apart from the Irish?
Philosophical influences? Well, I sort of... I made up my mind to explore what was common in all the belief systems in the world. Part of my interest in world peace. And so I started reading a lot about all the different religious philosophies and sifting out what was common with all of them. And it was about time and place, and there was always some sort of smoke involved. I was at Geary's mum's funeral yesterday. You know, the incense, and there was always water involved and fire and time and place and... So, and stories, you know. So, yeah, it was more of looking at all of them and trying to sift out the common elements of what seemed to be, make us as humans interested in whatever the spiritual is, yeah.
Now, your last name, Niyati,
yeah,
may not always have been your last name.
No, that's right.
But what does that mean? Where did that come from?
Okay, it's a sannyasin name, and it basically, being a strong feminist, I never wanted to join what I called a male hierarchy, a male-led hierarchy, but along the way, I got involved with the sannyasins in Fremantle and found that I just loved their singing and their dancing and the joy of life. And whenever you went to their houses, they were immaculately clean and beautiful gardens. There was an aesthetic. And so, yeah, I went to India for 3 months and went to the ashram and got involved with theatre. And I made some giant big butterfly wings and we had this big parade. So it was all just like, yeah, a lot of creativity, a lot of meditations where you danced and sang, and that was my thing. It was like, and the best thing about it was the philosophy is you don't follow a philosophy. You make a commitment to find out your own truth. So you, all of the things that you do in terms of, I wasn't going to choose sitting on, you know, cross-legged, silently, that wasn't my thing, but all the other things that you could do, the dancing and everything, it was just a way of finding an opportunity to find out what your own truth was. And that, so it wasn't like somebody else's philosophy, it was the idea that you could do all this sing and dance and celebration and then go into a silent space and find out what your own truth is. And the other thing is, learn to be a witness of your own behaviour, so that whatever's going on with yourself, you can actually, oh, I'm angry. Oh, that wasn't very nice, was it? Oh, you're having a great time. So learning the discipline of becoming a witness. Yeah.
So today, are you actively engaged in that furtherment of that same sannyasin philosophy?
Mainly in the friendships I have in the community and the support that we give each other. Yeah, so it's a very strong community in terms of, you know, we're all getting older now. So, yeah.
Well, it raises a question as we all get older. Is that something from the past? I think the answer perhaps is obvious that it's not, but is the sannyasin period behind us in Fremantle? Does it live? What?
Oh, yeah. Well, my friend, Satita, she's been running Zorba's Dance Club for the last 20 years, and we used to have it once a fortnight, and then we had it once a month. Now we have it once every 3 months, and a lot of people come by 9:30 they go home. But it doesn't matter, because the whole idea of Zorbas is you just dance. You become one with the dance. So it's not so much one where you do a partner dance, like a lot of my other dancing is with partners, but with Zorbas you just dance, dance and dance and dance until the thing is, I think it's a Sufi thing actually, that you become one with the dance. Yeah, so you don't identify, oh, am I doing it properly or are they doing it properly or whatever, you're just completely in the dance. So we still do that. So the celebration, which was always the biggest part, is still very much there.
Now, tell me this, what is there to be, I don't know, it sounds like a very, probably is a very male-orientated question, to be done in the world? What's to be done in Fremantle? What ambitions do you quietly hold about how we should be doing things differently into the future? Or are you content about where we're at?
Oh, I'm very happy about the direction we're going. But I would like to see much better and safer places for people that are homeless and people who, for one reason or another, have not been able to tap into the amazing thing that Fremantle is. So they're on the fringes and the margins. I'd like a lot more of that. And it's like, I don't think it makes sense to concentrate all our efforts in church-based organisations. I've seen being part of the community development world for more than 20 years that more and more the governments have found it much very comforting to put all the resources in church-based organisations. And it used to be a lot more community-based organisations. So I would like to see more community-based organisations being supported to offer. And a lot of them are working completely on a volunteer level. They need to be given a couple of things and people will do it, you know. So safe places for people who are homeless, is, yeah, definitely. And apart from that, I'd like to see more affordable housing for the creatives, because those 300 people that I'm saying that I know all live on really the fringes of income. I'd say nobody would earn more than $20,000 a year and they just survive. In a quality sort of a way, like myself, we have a great quality life, but I would like opportunities for people to live in and around Fremantle and keep that pulse going. I know there's stuff going on in White Gum Valley, but I think that's a bit academic. And we did do a bit of brainstorming about the use of electric cars and more shared transport and less need for garages and more shared fruit and veggies in the street, putting that sustainable stuff more into practice. The parks could be full of fruit trees, la la, yeah.
What do you think about the electric bicycle?
I think they're fine, except I don't want to ride one myself.
There's plenty who are. Look, it's been really fascinating talking to you, and thank you for speaking to Fremantle Shipping News. But before or as we finish, let me ask you this. When you think about all your time in Fremantle and what has happened here, and we haven't covered absolutely everything that you've been involved in. I'm thinking about the food co-op you established after the America's Cup, for example. What is it that you think Fremantle has to offer as a working laboratory to other communities?
Oh, okay, yes. Well, this is the thing. It's so sort of hidden and underground unless you're in. But that's why I'd love to write this book. you know, I would like to have 300 people with like a page each just to give examples of all the amazing things that people are doing. Because it can be done in any city, because we support each other economically, you know. So I think it is a microcosm for what can be done. And I can't talk about it now because, as I said, there's probably more than 300 now. There's probably 600. So, but certainly I would love all the examples of everything that's happening here to be documented so that then, yeah, other cities can go, oh. And it's really about people being prepared to take the chance and do, you know, the people who do dreadlocks for a living. My friend who teaches flamenco for a living. In fact, there's two women I know who teach flamenco for a living. There's so many things, you know, making kombucha tea. There's so many things that people are doing, yeah.
This is a community that thrives because of its grassroots.
I think it thrives because we actively support each other and we're actively and courageously creative. And, yeah, that's... I don't think I need to say more.
Well, I think that sums it up. Actively and courageously so. You epitomise that, I think. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael.
See you later.
Thank you very much.